This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I'm Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is my partner, Nick Duke. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well, and I can see that you're using tonight to test out your Calvin Harrison Wells impersonation.
You know me so well, Nick. You know me so Wells.
So, Wells.
Well, welcome once again, folks, to another rousing edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We're already getting off to a great start tonight, or today, whenever you're listening to us. I am Greg Phillips. He is Nick Duke. And we thank you for joining us for another edition of The Long Book Hunters. Now, as those of you who have listened to us in the past know, The Long Book Hunters is our monthly journey into the realm of trade paperbacks and graphic novels. Mm-hmm. Each month we try to look back at stories, some of which we've read before, some of which we've never read before. Well, this month, as many of you know, is a month all about love. You see, this month we are the Heart Traveling Fanboys with a T, and we are delving into things that we love. Pieces of comic book media that just tickle our proverbial fancies, or whatever else you want to throw in there besides fancies. And in this case, we are turning to one of our favorite comic book stories of all time. The greatest, and this is a spoiler alert for the entire episode, ladies and gentlemen, the greatest Green Lantern story of all time.
By a wide margin, by the way. Like,
by a wide margin.
I love me some Black as Night, but it can't even approach the greatness that was the Sinestro Corps War.
That's right. We are talking about, as Nick stole my thunder for, the Sinestro Corps War, the 2007-2008 Green Lantern event that encompassed both Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps.
That's right. It wasn't a story. It was an event.
It was an event. It was truly an event. And this one
was it truly
featured
a happening, though?
Well, they weren't hanging from the rafters, although they were hanging from various planet-like entities. So,
but were they banging while they were hanging?
Well, you'd have to go down to Tampa, brother, to find that out. I don't know what goes on in the Ed Leslie estate, but
and you know the last 3 seconds of this podcast, it just made the list.
It just made the list. Great point. That's right, Jennifer. Ed Leslie hanging and banging,
happening,
all kinds of things to merch online. But all that is to say, this is, in both of our opinions, one of the greatest comic book stories of all time. And like we said, by far the greatest Green Lantern story of all time. So what we're going to try to do here in this hour is essentially verbal fellatio on the creators of this story.
Yep.
And try to explain to you why this is the greatest Green Lantern story of all and why it just may be, as I think my latest rereading has convinced me, the greatest of the modern superhero event stories.
And if we fail to do all that, at the very least, it'll devolve into something like the old Chris Farley SNL sketch where we're like, hey, remember when there was the Battle of Mogo?
That was awesome.
That was awesome. Yep, so
let it be known, if we ever do get an interview with Jeff Johns on this show,
it'll be that, essentially.
It'll be that. You remember when you did Batman Earth 1? Yeah, that was good.
You remember the opening scene of your Aquaman run?
Yeah, I do. I wrote it.
But
do you remember it?
good
stuff. Anyway, so the Sinestro Corps War. I'm currently looking at the gorgeous absolute edition of the Sinestro Corps War, which if you're a fan of this story, highly recommend you pony up the money to get it because it is a beautiful part of any collection. blown up art, everything, the incredible print and production quality of this. The slipcase is wonderful. The cover is wonderful. Hand-drawn art on it from the likes of Ethan Van Sciver and Ivan Rice. Even Andy Kubert, actually, on the interior. So, really cool stuff. But anyway, the creative team involved in this, it's massive. But the ones listed on the back here are Jeff Johns, Dave Gibbons, Peter J. Tomasi, Ivan Rice, Patrick Gleason, and Ethan Van Sciver. Also not mentioned there, one of the other key artistic contributors is a guy named Angel Unzueta, who co-drew alongside Patrick Gleason a lot of most of the Green Lantern Corps issues in here. Mm-hmm. Dustin Nguyen also helped out, Jamal Eagle, and the colors are phenomenal in this book, as we'll get to later on. Moose Bauman, Guy Major, Rod Reese, David Curiel, and J.D. Smith. So a metric ton, as the kids say. I think the kids say that. Maybe I just say that. A metric ton of artistic and creative talent here. But it all goes back to the brainchild of Jeff Johns and Ethan Van Sciver, with an assist from Peter Tomasi. And this dates back to the very beginning of Jeff Johns' run on Green Lantern. And as we've talked about in the past, Nick, Jeff began his run with Green Lantern Rebirth, a book that we've discussed here on the podcast several months ago with Jennifer Smith. And after that, Jeff embarked on his, of course, decade-long run on the Green Lantern title. Simultaneously, the book Green Lantern Corps was launched by writer Dave Gibbons, known for his work in Watchmen, of course. He's the legendary artist behind Watchmen, arguably the greatest graphic novel of all time. So you had that creative powerhouse heading up Green Lantern Corps with artistic edges from Patrick Gleason, and you had Jeff Johns heading up Green Lantern. Meanwhile, Johns was kind of coursing the entire plot of the Green Lantern, or plotting the course even, not coursing the plot, because that's not something that happens, but plotting the course of the entire Green Lantern mythos. And after the success of Green Lantern Rebirth, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Nick, Jeff and Ethan Van Sciver kind of roughly sketched out an idea for a trilogy, and there are many references to it in interviews around the time building up to the Sinestro Corps, that Jeff and Ethan and Tomasi had this idea for a trilogy of sorts that Rebirth was the first part of. And the second part was a long ways off from 2005 when Rebirth ended. But Jeff was clear that he was building towards something. We just didn't know what it would entail.
Yeah, that's my understanding of it as well. Granted, I'm not as learned on the creative development of the story as you potentially are. So, but that sounds right based on all the things I have read over the years. Some have theorized that Jeff had the entire thing sketched out before Rebirth, but I most of the things I've read back up what you're saying, that they developed the next two installments in the story, you know, in the wake of Rebirth's release.
Right, and I think if you go back and read Rebirth, there are hints of what's to come later on. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I've read in some interviews from around that time is that Jeff found himself coming up with all these ideas for the Green Lantern mythology and putting them in there almost subconsciously. And after the fact, going back and reading Rebirth, suddenly the wheels were turning for this long-form plan. And so by the time he got to the end of Rebirth, he kind of had an idea of where he wanted to go. And then once they saw how successful it was, and once his Green Lantern title was off the ground, then it came time to actually sit down and flesh it out. And that's when we got some of the finer details. And if you read – anybody that's read Jeff Johns' Green Lantern run, what makes it so beautiful and so wonderful is from the very first issue, even including Rebirth, the seeds are being planted for things that didn't happen for 3, 4, 5, sometimes 10 years down the road. And it's something that if you go back and you read that run between Rebirth and Sinestro Corps War, which is about a 2-year gap there between those two stories –
Rebirth was 05, and the beginning of the one shot that kicked off Sinestro Corps War came out in the summer of 07, so about a 2-year gap there.
Yeah, a little bit more, because Rebirth ended in 05, but I think it started in like November of 04, so We'll say about 2 years, but in that 2 years, a lot happened, and a lot of little things were shown in the background, characters were shown in the background, things that were planted in Rebirth were expounded on, and we started to see that something was going on in the Green Lantern universe, and as it progressed, as those 2 years progressed, the little seeds grew, plants grew into trees, grew into planet-sized hints of what was to come, and it's one of the best examples you'll ever find of playing the long game in superhero comics. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely.
And so that led us into what we're talking about today, the Sinestro Corps War. When it came out, it was something of a unique entity at the time, because the trend starting in about 05 or 04 in Super Comics became the yearly crossover event comic.
Yeah, starting with House of M, which I think was 2004.
I think you're right.
Sounds right. Although Civil War didn't drop until 06, so I guess Marvel had a 2 year gap between their events, unless you count Secret War would have been after House of M.
Yeah, that would have been 05.
I'm getting my Marvel chronology mixed up, but essentially the idea was that House of M and then Infinite Crisis kind of right after it represented, for both of the major companies, a return to big-time event storytelling. Now, the thought was, I think amongst a lot of people, that DC was going to annualize that format the same way Marvel has since, even taking it to the twice a year or even three times a year events. But so when Sinestro Corps came out and it was announced that it was going to be released not as a standalone event title, but rather take place contained within the Green Lantern books themselves, I think there was a lot of surprise about that.
Yeah, it was kind of a hyped event, and at the time DC had, I want to make sure I get my chronology right here, they, from Infinite Crisis led into 52, and then 52 led into Countdown to Final Crisis, and I think that was going on around the time of the Sinestro Corps War, or maybe a little bit before, but the kind of the benefit, I guess, of that event going on is that it allowed Geoff Johns and his team to kind of fly under the radar from DC corporate and not really deal with any corporate interference on the story they were trying to tell. So Geoff got his little corner of the universe and was able to keep it contained to Green Lantern and to Green Lantern Corps, which he has often said was always his goal with all of his event titles after Infinite Crisis, was to keep Blackest Night, Sinestro Corps War, etc., confined to the Green Lantern titles. And it worked out for Blackest Night, but for Sinestro Corps War, I think it was essential that it remained a Green Lantern-centered event, and it made it all the better because you didn't have all the pointless tie-ins, you didn't have all of the corporate interference, the mandate to kill Dick Grayson during the middle of the story, so it was
that's a Danny D special right there.
That's right. I can see it now. Okay, what if we had a character, let's say a former Robin who's currently Nightwing, not naming any names here. What if we had him get beheaded by Sinestro and then thrown into a garbage heap? And yes, I'm aware that my Dan Didio talks like Vince Russo, but.
Yeah, a little bit more, it has a deeper tone to it than your Vince Russo.
Yeah, Russo's a little bit higher pitched, but in any event, this was a story that took place over the course of issues of Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps. We also got as we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a moment, Nick, one of the greatest single issue comics of all time, the Sinestro Corps Special, which kicked off a special. I don't know how many pages it was, but a blown up special.
I don't know exactly how many pages, but it's a long oversized. I want to say maybe triple size, so maybe like 65, 80 pages somewhere in that realm, but I don't know that for a fact.
And we got really cool Tales of the Sinestro Corps backup tales and issues that really helped flesh out the entire Sinestro Corps story, and it. Because it stayed contained unto itself, it didn't have that kind of unwieldiness that all of these like modern crossover event books tend to fall into.
Right. It kind of had the best of both worlds because it was able to play with some of the elements from the larger DC universe, whether it be the Justice League or the Teen Titans or whoever you want to throw out there. It pretty much had all the pieces on the board when it came time for the big climactic showdown but like you said, didn't have to really subject itself to editorial interference or have to run its plots by the writers of those books or have other books be tied up with that. Like, for example, one of the first things I remember, I know I read this after the fact, but now in my memory, it is cemented as the first chronological tease that I vividly remember of the Sinestro Corps War is the Yellow Ring offering itself to Batman. And I know that happened in the story itself, and I can't remember which book it happened in.
No, that happened. Yeah, that happened actually, I want to say we're talking very early in Geoff Johns' run. Like,
right.
If I remember correctly, I think that happened in the first Raid collection. There's a Batman cross issue. And I think that's or maybe it's the second trade collection, but I think that's when the ring offered itself to Batman, and he said basically, "What the hell is that?"
Yeah.
Tremendous. So let's let people know. Obviously, a couple months ago, we did an episode of Countdown where we counted down our favorite Geoff Johns Green Lantern comics, and both of us had it number one. The issue that kicks off the Sinestro Corps War, first chapter of this book.
That is not accurate. Both of us had it number one, the issue that ends the Sinestro Corps War.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Yep. That's right. But both of us had on the list
The
issue that kicks off the Sinestro Corps War, which should tell you, by the way, how good this story is. And that is the Sinestro Corps War special. Now, rereading this story, it only magnified why it's the greatest thing chapter, perhaps, of any comic story. It's just mind-boggling, all of the story that is told in these pages. From Sinestro, the ominous scene at the beginning of the issue where Sinestro forms his core, forges his ring, forges this battery. And then you see the corruption of Kyle Rayner as he is taken and tortured and transformed into the new host for Parallax. You see the formation of the Sinestro Corps, the gathering of these characters. And of course, we see that iconic last page reveal of the big hitters for the Sinestro Corps, which of course are Sinestro, Superman Prime, the Anti-Monitor, Cyborg Superman, and Parallax. Pretty much five powerful villains in the DC universe outside of Darkseid. So nothing could get the blood pumping and to get you to say, oh my God, how in the world are the good guys going to get through this one? Which is ultimately the idea behind superhero comics from the dawn of them, is put the heroes in peril and make the audience wonder how they're going to get out of that peril.
And
that's what this issue does.
Absolutely. And just to call out a couple of moments from the issue, the Despotellis reveal of what actually happened to Kyle Rayner's mother, I thought, still going back to it now, is one of the best reveals, I think, ever in comics. Like, Geoff Johns taking that and revealing that it was all part of Nestro's master plan was absolutely, like, just mind-numbingly good. And also, the interactions of the Lanterns on Oa, where you still see how they're treating Hal as an outcast, making it so that, really, like, you could pick up Rebirth and go straight to the Sinestro Corps War if you're a new reader without having to read all of that, because Johns does such a great idea of giving you a primer on what the dynamic is between Hal and the rest of the Corps without necessarily needing all of that connective tissue. Now, granted, the story absolutely holds up better if you have all tissue, but you don't necessarily need it if you're in a hurry.
Right. I was going to say the same. Like, it's been a long time since I've read the issues leading into this. It does help if you know who all the characters are and you're familiar with all seeds that have been planted. But if you've not seen any of those teases, if you've not seen any of the kind of hints that had been thrown in there or the buildup that had been leading into this, you're not lost. Johns and Gibbons do such a great job, and Johns in this issue especially, do such a great job of, like you said, putting the reader up, getting the reader up to speed, and kind of throwing you in here with characters that are clearly defined, which is one of Geoff Johns' strengths as a writer, his ability to write clearly defined characters. His characters don't talk the same. They don't have the same voice. They don't think the same. They don't act the same. And when Ethan Van Sciver draws them, they don't look the same. They don't have the same uses for the ring. It's just the artwork in the issue is incredible. And it just gets the whole thing off to this wonderful start. And it makes you believe that this reveal could actually break Kyle Rayner to the point that he would be corrupted the same way that Hal was years ago because of the way that it's done. And the idea of a Sinestro Corps member that is a living virus is really awesome.
Yep. It really is. You kind of have that great, you know, you kind of run the gamut here of all the different forms of alien you can think of, from a living virus to a sentient planet and everything in between. I mean, there are, you know, splash pages, even in that opening issue where they reveal the core kind of massing around Sinestro, and you see, like, all these different alien designs, and the detail is just amazing. I mean, that issue is a reason why I have always said that, you know, Ethan Van Sciver will be my favorite Green Lantern artist until the day I die, I think.
There's also a great, and this is going to be a weird thing for people to hear. You're going to hear me actually praise Kyle Rayner in this episode of Park Traveling Fanboys, because his characterization in this is incredible. And I had forgotten how enjoyable they had made Kyle at this point, like through Green Lantern Corps and through Johns when he could handle him as well. And there's this great synergy in the book where when Kyle gets transformed into Parallax, the Parallax-infused Kyle just says cool in this first issue. And fast forward to the second-to-last issue of Green Lantern, Green Lantern number 24, when Kyle finally gets his ring back and becomes a Green Lantern again, says the same exact thing. Really cool bit of synergy there in the book, which is something that Jeff was great at as well, is building up synergy between Rebirth and this. And that in this case, you see Kyle go through all the same things that Hal went through in Rebirth, just in an accelerated format. So
yeah, Kyle, you know, under the watchful eye of Geoff Johns, fantastic. Kyle, when he's forced down our throats as the most powerful lantern of them all and literally stealing Hal's girlfriend just so we can be beaten about the head and neck area with how much better he is than Hal, not so awesome.
Yep. And wearing an ugly white suit.
Yep.
Yes, absolutely. So I guess we kind of put the cart before the horse here, because we haven't actually told people that haven't ever read it or don't know what it is, what the Sinestro Corps War is. Well, as you would expect from the title, it's a war book. Essentially, this is a space war book. Picture, and I'll go ahead and say it, it's the most obvious comparison, because this is how Jeff himself pitched it in the early going. It's Star Wars. It is a Star Wars meets James Bond meets Lord of the Rings type deal. And that kind of encompasses the Green Lantern Corps in general. But this story really does feel like The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. You know, it feels like everything that happened in Rebirth has been ripped up. And you've basically got these two warring factions. You've got the Green Lantern Corps, who represent willpower, who represent peaceful law and order in the universe, and you got the Sinestro Corps War, whose leader, Sinestro, is the fallen member of the Green Lantern Corps, who was once this Green Lantern, who was overthrown because of his tyrannical ways, and now has formed his own corps that is driven by fear instead of willpower. He wants to make the entire universe afraid of him and rule that way, not unlike a Nazi-type regime. Mm-hmm. And in the middle, you've got the Guardians of the Universe, who are the overlords of the Green Lanterns, but whose arrogance has unwittingly led to all of this. So it's this incredible story of political machinations, gritty war violence, superheroic fantasy, all of this stuff thrown together. Ultimately, it's just the most fun that you'll ever have reading a superhero action-based comic book.
Right, and a lot of times when people use the word fun, you know, Greg, that when you and I hate the usage of the word, it typically means, you know, kind of frivolous and without depth. But there is a lot of depth and honestly a lot of darkness in this story too. So while a tremendous amount of fun to read, it also tugs the emotional heartstrings in a way that a lot of superhero comics that set out to be fun don't necessarily accomplish.
It cuts, and this is another thing that hit me today as I was finishing reading it. It cuts a pace that, in my opinion, every superhero comic, regardless of what it's trying to do, should reach for, mm-hmm. should try to match, because the pace of this story is unrelenting, even when it's a slowdown issue.
Right. Even when it's trying to delve into the characters, it's still moving the larger plot forward in a very aggressive way. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. And you get along the way, you're exposed to. This is the book to put in people's hands to show them why Green Lantern is the richest mythology in DC Comics, because this is not like, and this is no knock on these characters, they're amazing characters. This is not like the Batman family. This is not like the Superman family. This is not like the Teen Titans family. None of that. Nothing like Justice League. This is truly the most diverse, multifaceted group of characters you will ever encounter in comics. There is, if you can't find a Green Lantern that speaks to you, I don't know what to tell you, because this book alone reminded me of characters that I've forgotten about over the years because they've gone by the wayside in recent years. But characters like Still, the robotic Green Lantern, Jack T. Chance, Stell's partner Green Man, which I wanted to call attention to this early Green Lantern Corps issue, where there's this amazingly moving scene that I didn't expect, where Green Man is out in space, and he was named that earlier in Green Lantern Corps. That's why he's got a corny name. Guy Gardner named him, so that's why he's got the corny name Green Man. He's out in space, and he's looking for Stell, who has been destroyed by one of the Sinestro Corps members, seemingly. And he's out in the depths of space, and his ring keeps telling him the probability of survival is estimated at 0.01%, and the ring is ordering him to return back to Oa to comply with the Guardians. And Green Man, in this great bit of art by Patrick Gleason, he says, "I know I'm behaving like an Earthman, but I can't do that. Stell is my friend." And there's this great bit of art where he just breaks down crying in the middle of deep space, and before he finds his partner eventually. So, I mean, I had completely forgotten that they were even partners. And of course, you see Soren Ignatiu, one of the best modern-day Green Lantern additions. You see Kahan, the jerk Lost Lantern, who gets his in the end, I'll say that. But he acts like an ass to Hal Jordan the whole time. You see these...
being a complete badass.
Yes! Okay, a Green Lantern who is a fly, who ends up being one of the most badass Green Lanterns of all time.
Yep, pretty much.
And it makes you root for him. You know, all Vath and Issamot, two of the great characters from Dave Gibbons' run, reminded me of how great they are together. You see so many of these amazing Green Lanterns, Arisia and Lyra and Boudica and, of course, Sodom Yat, who really gets to step up front and center in this story for the first time. There's just so many great, great characters that are introduced that are featured throughout this story, and all of them have these subplots going on, whether it's their personal relationship with each other, how Vath doesn't accept Sodom Yat at first, and then finally grudgingly respects Kilowog, who is kind of got this personal rivalry going on with Arkillo, who is Sinestro's kind of first lieutenant, I guess you would say.
Yep.
And the way that they layer these characters, and even in the midst of an action-based storyline, which this clearly is, because there's war in every issue, even in the midst of that, you never lose sight of the characters, you never lose sight of their motivations, and you never lose sight of why you're rooting for or against each of these characters.
Absolutely. And then also on the Sinestro Corps side, you've got tons of interesting characters that were introduced here as well, whether it's Arkillo, like you said, or Lissa Drak, or Despotelis, or Karusil, or Crib, who we see the first introduction of her here, even though she isn't given a ton of page time. She would go on to become a very creepy, intimidating villainess in later Green Lantern adventures. So, just so many.
And what about the Erasmos, who I'd forgotten about, one of the key members of the Sinestro Corps, who kind
almost
of was like
the, almost like the counterpoint to Salak is what I
to think. Salak. Yep, that's exactly what I was thinking when I was reading him. He was kind of the strategist of the Corps, giving out kind of orders on where people were to go and things like that. I had completely forgotten about him, and he kind of reminded me a little bit of Grand Moff Tarkin, actually. Because and there's also a great scene in the book where you see the cyborg Superman, who I'm sure we're going to touch on as well in a little bit. Another of the best characters in this story. Cyborg Superman is given more depth. And listen, no knock on anything that was done with him before. I love Dan Jurgens. I love the death of Superman. I love Reign of the Superman. I feel like there was more depth given to Cyborg Superman in Jeff Johns' arc of Green Lantern featured him and in the Sinestro Corps than there was in the previous 10 years of his existence.
I think that's fair to say. Absolutely. And then
you
also
see that this great scene that's almost that's very reminiscent of Empire Strikes Back, where Cyborg Superman is kneeling before the Anti-Monitor, who, and he makes the Anti-Monitor promise that he will kill him and when this is all over, because that's all Cyborg Superman wants, is to be killed, because he's had all these near-death experiences and he just can't die, and all he wants to do is end his suffering.
Yep, absolutely.
Very powerful.
Absolutely, and of course, you know, one of the first characters that the Sinestro Corps breaks out is a character that's near and dear to our hearts, Greg, and that, of course, is Superman Prime, which for those who are unfamiliar with Prime, he is basically a version of Superman from our Earth, for lack of a better term. Basically, he came from an Earth where the only superheroes that existed were ones in comic books, and he was revealed to be the one superhero on that Earth, and he was the Superman of that Earth, and he had just, you know, learned about his powers and had, you know, set off on his adventure to become Superman when Crisis on Infinite Earths happened.
Right, and at that time, he was known as Superboy, and he came back in Infinite Crisis in 2005 as Superboy Prime, and was basically the biggest threat that had ever hit this version of the DC Universe. Killed a bunch of heroes. It took the combined might of two different Supermen and a bunch of speedsters to finally take him down.
Because he had lost his mind. I mean, we should clarify.
Right.
He went on a killing spree because he had lost his mind because his Earth had been destroyed, and he felt that the Earth that remained behind, the Earth of the DC Universe as we know it, was basically unworthy and should not have continued on.
Yep. And he ended up getting imprisoned inside a red sun and locked in a Green Lantern cyan cell and surrounded by hundreds of or dozens of Green Lanterns to guard him in case he ever escaped somehow. Well, Sinestro finds a way to distract and to free him, and he goes on another rampage. Although it's so great how it builds throughout the, because you really don't see Superboy Prime except for little glimpses here and there, or Superman Prime at this point. He's become that. You don't really see him except for little glimpses here and there throughout the story. Maybe a little like panel here or there that'll just show his eyes or show him smirking until the last two issues, when he all of a sudden is part of this invading force of Sinestro Corps members that comes to Earth. And, well, let's just say wrecks shop.
Yep. It unleashes one of the best superhero fight scenes of all time. He has a big showdown with the new torchbearer of the Corps, Sodom Yacht, who has been granted the Ion Entity. Now, the Ion Entity is essentially the counterpoint to Parallax. So if you know your Green Lantern Earth, you know Parallax was revealed to be the living embodiment of fear that possessed the body of Hal Jordan. Ion is revealed to be the green living embodiment of willpower that at the beginning of the story is present in Kyle Rayner. But as Greg referenced earlier, Kyle eventually makes the choice to return to being, for lack of a better term, a regular member of the Corps, and the Guardians grant Sodom Yacht, who is a Daxamite, a close cousin of the Kryptonians. So they grant him this Ion power, but because he's a Daxamite, he also has enhanced abilities under Earth's yellow sun, basically making him Superman on steroids.
Yep, exactly. And there's a great scene in the first issue where he's still in his little prison cell, and Guy Gardner, who's one of the Lanterns guarding him, flies him and says, "Hope you're having fun in there, kid. My ass sends its love." So
as he taunts him with a somewhat seductive construct of Supergirl, with the wind blowing up her skirt a little bit.
just Guy being Guy.
Classic
and,
Guy Gardner. Vintage and Guy Gardner.
Vintage Guy Gardner. He also has some great lines later in the book when the Lanterns are seemingly getting their butts kicked, and Hal out of nowhere brings up guy's old jacket from the 90s that had the D on it. And John Stewart says, you remember what he said it stood for? And Hal says, yeah, girl magnet. And then guy's like, why don't you just focus on keeping your hair from turning white, Jordan? Which is a great joke that only longtime Green Lantern fans will get. But great moments for all of the Lanterns. John Stewart gets some killer moments in this, particularly when he is fighting with Parallax, and he says, the only thing I got to do is stay black, and then blows a hole through Parallax's head, which was pretty damn cool. But then, like you said, the fight between Superman Prime and Sodom Yacht stands as one of the highlights of the book. The fight scene is just incredible. I believe that was Patrick Gleason that drew that one, and it's one of the best of all time in superhero comics. It's bloody, it's brutal, yep. And it's not just the fight, because during the fight, basically Sodom Yacht's entire life is flashing before his eyes, and
So it makes it so that if you're a new reader coming into the story and you don't have the first clue who Sodom Yacht is, that issue not only shows you how powerful and how cool he can be, but it also tells you everything you need to know about his character and his motivations basically in one single issue. So it's just a fantastic, you know, masterclass really in single issue storytelling.
Totally. And so the conflict in this book seemingly is pretty straightforward. Sinestro is trying to overthrow the Green Lantern Corps and replace it with his own. But as we find out through the course of the story, as it plays out, there's a lot more going on here than just a battle between two forces. There's Sinestro's endgame is not necessarily what you would think it would be. His goal is not necessarily to defeat the Green Lanterns in hand-to-hand combat, although that would be a plus probably to him. But he's got others in mind that are set in motion by this story. So it's a book that with each chapter there's new things unveiled, there's new landmark scenes that stand out, and there's new things that kind of add to what's going on on the surface, which is a bunch of heroes fighting a bunch of villains. And we didn't even mention Amon Sur, the son of Abin Sur, one of the greatest Green Lanterns who died and passed his ring on to Hal Jordan. He's a member of the Sinestro Corps. Who had a history with Hal Jordan in Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run. He had run across him and was bitter because he didn't think Jordan was worthy of his dad's ring. He thought he should have gotten his dad's ring. Well, it's kind of the ultimate betrayal to then go and work for somebody who represents, you know, the opposite of what the Green Lantern Corps was built on. So there's just a ton going on here. And the Anti-Monitor, the biggest, baddest villain in DC lore, the guy who was responsible for what is still considered the most important crossover event book in DC history, The Crisis on Infinite Earths back in the 80s, as a member of the Sinestro Corps. Not really a member, but the guardian for the Sinestro Corps War. You know, they've got their own, like, inverted version of the Green Lanterns. And in this, the Anti-Monitor is basically the Sinestro Corps' guardian. Mm-hmm. And let's just say he's a little bit more decisive than the blue skin guys we're used to.
Yes, but I think an important part of the story to mention is that there are two blue skin characters here who are trying to be decisive and who are kind of responsible ultimately for the Green Lantern's success, even though they are ostracized from the Guardians of the Universe as a result. And those, of course, would be the characters of Ganthet. Now, Greg, I know Ganthet had been a character that had been named for a while there in the Green Lantern mythos, but when did Syed kind of take on her own personality? I think it was not long before this, correct?
It was very shortly before this, because they actually make reference to it in this, in that one of the other Guardians kind of scoffs at the idea that she has chosen to name herself. And it was a big deal, because to that point, Ganthet had been the only Guardian that had taken a name, at least in the current iteration of Guardian. There had been others in the past, Krona, etc.
The old timer.
But, yeah, the old timer, yeah. But in the modern incarnation, Ganthet was the only one that had a name. And he and Syed, or Syed, or however you pronounce it, they are the two Guardians who start to question everything that they've preached for so many centuries, which is that emotion is bad and that, you know, they need to push emotion to the side and any Green Lantern that acts on emotion is acting irrationally. They're arguing that they should embrace emotion because they see this prophecy that's coming, which is a prophecy called the Blackest Night that was first referenced way back in the 80s in those incredible get your hands on them and read them Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons issues of Green Lantern, and also Kevin Maguire as well.
I actually think those, the one that you're referencing, took place in an issue of Tales of the Green Lantern Corps,
yep.
which was a quarterly book they were doing, I believe,
yep.
at the time.
Yep, that's correct. That was the book Tigers, if memory serves.
The story Tigers, yes.
So, all that ties back to that. There are also other ideas that were introduced in that prophecy that you start to see play out. So, not who we mentioned earlier, Ranks, the sentient city, which was referenced in that story way back when, is brought into play in a big, big way, and had popped up in Green Lantern Corps before Sinestro Corps War, mm-hmm. but comes to play in a big, big way here.
As Ranks, the sentient planet.
As Ranks, the sentient planet. Yes, he'd been built up to basically to engage in one-on-one battle with Mogo, and who is, of course, another Alan Moore concept from the 80s, the Green Lantern who is a planet.
Yep.
And definitely one of the most badass of Green Lanterns, arguably the most powerful of the Green Lanterns. So you see a lot of ties back, thematic ties to the history of the Green Lantern Corps, little nuggets that are expounded upon here. And it basically touches upon all of the hallmarks of what you need in a Green Lantern story. You need space. There's plenty of space in this. You need some concept of adventure. Ton of that. There's even exploring that goes on as search for the Ion entity within Ranks. Within Cord.
Yep.
You need conflict. Obviously, we got that. You need a little bit of romance thrown in, and there are a couple of different relationships going on here. The one that seems to get the most focus in this story is the growing attraction of Arisia to the rookie Green Lantern Sodom Yacht. Mm-hmm. Which will play into factor in later Green Lantern stories. And you need, of course, a message of willpower overcoming fear. And that's ultimately what this whole book is about. And it culminates in our pick for the best issue in Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run, and one of the best issues of any comic ever, Green Lantern number 25, where basically the entire premise of Green Lantern comics is summed up in one issue. But it takes place also over the course of this entire story. Whether it's you see the city rally behind Hal Jordan and rally behind the concept of not giving in to your fears. Whether it's seeing Cyborg Superman and his journey that he goes on through this story. Superman Prime and his it's in a weird way, the villains kind of get what they want in the end, which is an interesting Empire Strikes Back kind of way to end the story. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely, yeah. Because one of the major story points that happens is the Sinestro Corps has the ability to kill using their rings, an ability that the Green Lanterns do not have. There are numerous instances in the early part of the story where a Lantern tries to use lethal force and their ring shuts down on them. Because it's been forbidden by the Book of Oa. Well, once Agantha and Syed are expelled from the Guardians enact 10 new laws for the Book of Oa, and the first of which is revealed here in this story, and it is the ability to use lethal force against a Sinestro Corps member, and it's ultimately revealed that that's all Sinestro wanted the entire time.
Yeah, and even Superman Prime, in a way, gets what he wanted because he gets transported to Earth at the end. It's a very interesting way to end the story and to end it in an ominous way where the good guys are triumphant. Spoiler alert: if you had any doubt that the good guys eventually win in the end, seemingly, but you're left with that nagging question, the same question that Sinestro leaves Hal with: did they really win after all? And just a wonderful story, and there's plenty of teases for Blackest Night throughout the story, but this in and of itself is a self-contained masterpiece. It never slows down. It never gets boring. There's always something to pay attention to in the artwork. Ivan Reis, in particular, I want to draw attention to. because his work in the Green Lantern issues is just to die for, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whether it's Ivan Reis or Pat Gleason, who you called out earlier, or of course Ethan Van Sciver, the art, the coloring, everything is absolutely fantastic. Even in an early issue, the lettering. I specifically remember the lettering for Reverse Flash's brief appearance.
Oh my God, no, yeah. Yeah.
Because it's all blurred together and kind of got vibrations around it. It looks really cool. It really conveys that theme of constant motion for the Reverse Flash.
Yeah, very, very cool usage of that. And another great little tie-in to John's other – a little nod, I think, to fans of John's, because at that time, Hunter Zell was the main villain in his Flash run, or actually it was before that, but he had been the main villain in his Flash run, so you see him pop up very briefly and
you know,
get away.
That's something that I thought of while I was reading this. Now, granted, Greg, you're much more with the Jeff Johns Flash than I am, but okay, so one of the main themes of the conflict between Zolomon and the Flash in that run is Zolomon's desire to make the Flash the best Flash he can be, correct?
Right.
Very much, isn't this the Green Lantern version of that story with Sinestro simply seeking to make the Green Lantern the Green Lantern Corps what he feels would be the best version of the Green Lantern Corps they can be?
In a way, I think the difference is Zolomon genuinely wants to help Wally West become the best Wally West can be. With Sinestro, he really doesn't care if Hal Jordan becomes the best Hal Jordan he can be. He just wants order brought to the universe, and he wants the Green Lantern Corps to evolve into what he views as a force that can truly create order in the universe. For Zolomon, it wasn't about the overall effects or how many lives got saved. For him, he just wanted to see he wanted the Flash to be, in his mind, what the Flash could and should be. And he thought that to do that, he needed to go through more tragedy, because in Zolomon's eyes, you can't be a hero unless you've undergone tremendous personal tragedy. So just a little bit different takes on it. But yeah, they do have thematic similarities for sure. This feels like a blown up and improved upon version of the Blitz story arc from Flash, except on the Green Lantern scale, it of course involves so many other people than right. just your main hero and your main villain. But I think with Zolomon, he's a little bit more psychotic probably, but also maybe a little bit more understandable in some weird ways. With Sinestro, it's kind of like you don't realize until the end kind of where he's coming from, and you're kind of like, no, it's not worth it what he did and what he threatened. But in a way, I get where he's coming from. Mm-hmm. And you never really – by the end of Hunter Zolomon's turn with all the things that he had done, there was no point when you really felt any sympathy for him. With Sinestro, it's kind of the opposite. You start out hating him, and then by the end, you're kind of asking yourself, like, you know, as bad as this guy is, he kind of had some points.
Speaking of the Flash, I wanted to call back to a moment where Superman Prime visits the statue of Bart Allen and re-inscribes the citation. Do you remember what it was exactly, Greg?
oh gosh, I should know this. I can't remember off the top of my head.
I think they take it from Bart Allen, the Flash, fastest man alive, to Bart Allen, the stupidest boy dead.
The stupidest boy dead. Yep, that's what it was.
And
yep.
That was the moment, Greg, where it all clicked for me. I had been reading, you know, my most recent reread. I was reading Superman Prime's, you know, words and thinking, God, this just sounds so. Solicit and petulant. He kind of sounds like, and then I read that, and I was like, if you change that one word from stupidest boy dead to stupidest idiot dead, Superman Prime is Chris Jericho.
Oh, God. Kid Flash, you just made the list. You know what happens? You know what happens when you call yourself Kid Flash? You know what happens when you send me through the Speed Force? Huh? Bart Allen? You just made the list! Nick Duke, you have made my life, sir.
Thank you. Seriously, go back and read all his dialogue. It does sound very much like a 2016 Chris Jericho bit.
It does. You are right about that. That is fantastic. Stupidest idiot dead. I like that. That's very, very good. The assault on Earth, of course, is one of the highlights of the book. When the Sinestro Corps comes down, you get all your big climactic battles. But before that, there's a 2-issue run of Green Lantern Corps that features the Battle of Mogo and the Battle of Ranks.
Right.
And two of the best, I'm going to go ahead and call them war comics that you'll ever read, because what they are essentially is war comics that just happen to take place in space. They're phenomenal.
Yep. Absolutely. You know, it's the rare instance of an event book where they bounce back and forth between two different casts of characters, and quite unquestionably, you know, Hal and Guy and John, who are being featured in Green Lantern, are, you know, they're the quote-unquote main characters, but you never feel like the story loses any momentum when it takes a moment to feature the other cast of characters. I mean, it doesn't miss a
right.
beat the entire time.
How many times have we read crossover events where we find ourselves saying, I really love the parts with character X, but man, I dread it when they switch the focus back to character Y.
Right.
That's happened in so many comic book events. Never happens here. Because when they switch back to Kilowog and his crew, it's interesting. When they go to Sodom Yat and his crew, it's interesting. When they go to the Guardians, it's interesting. When they go to Hal and John and Guy and Kyle, it's interesting. When they go to the Sinestro Corps and they show their little stuff going on, it's all interesting. And I just can't say enough about how it builds to a climax and how even the artwork seems to build to this climax, to the point where by the time you get to that last issue, and I'm looking at some of the pages right now of Hal and Sinestro's fight at the end, where Hal punches Sinestro through this big glass pane, and the art just feels so much, so energetic,
mm-hmm.
and it's going back and forth between like two
what
or
about
three
that splash scenes. Page in the last issue that gives us our first glimpse of light, of the prophecy of the War of Light?
Oh,
what a splash page!
Yep, certainly reminiscent of things or prescient of things to come, which again we've talked about so often about Geoff Johns, his ability to lay the foundation for an entire mythos and to actually pay it off, because the stuff that was laid out in Rebirth and in issue number one of Green Lantern and in issue number one of Green Lantern Corps Recharge, that stuff is paid off down the line. It's like the opposite of WWE storytelling, where things get teased and never paid off. Here, it all pays off, and it leaves you wanting more. But not in a way you're satisfied with this story, but it leaves you wanting to read more. And that's a really hard balancing act to find, where it both satisfies you as an ending and also leaves you wanting to read where it goes next.
Absolutely. You said it perfect, Bubba.
So as we get here to the end of it, let's talk real quick about some of our highlights or favorite points of the story, which we talked about a lot of them already. I think for me, the entire Battle of Mogo issue is damn fine superhero comic. The Prime and Yacht battle that we've already talked about, the last issue that we've already talked about. I also want to call attention to the way that Johns and Gibbons build up their supporting characters that aren't like the prime focus in Green Lantern Corps is Kilowog, Arisia, and a handful of other lanterns.
But the
supplemental lanterns are also made to feel important, so that when they die, if they die, Kahan, for instance, when one of them dies, it feels like a big deal. The lantern who has the really complicated name that I'm not going to attempt to pronounce right now, it's 3 CH names in a row.
Kuthos, Chithos, or something like that?
Something like that, yeah. He died, and I had forgotten it happened, and it caught me off guard when it happened, because it just kind of comes out of nowhere, and I'm like, oh my God. And you can just feel that their brother has just been killed, you know, and it's a that's another thing that stood out to me, was that throughout the story. What about you? What are some of the highlights we haven't touched on yet?
The moment with Hal and Kyle both inside Parallax. I remember that one. And when they're able to finally shake together, you know, use their combined willpower to shake Kyle free of the Parallax entity. I really, really enjoyed that. The issue early in the story where Sinestro goes to Korugar and is basically taunting Sora Nagnatu and playing a game with her that we would not realize the true implications of for, God, what feels like years down the road, you know? Those both are just moments that stand out to me in a big way, you know, other than obviously the ones that we've already mentioned.
Right. I forgot about that issue. I was going to mention that, but it's so early in the story that I think I had forgotten to mention it tonight. You're right. That issue where Sinestro visits Korugar, and having the knowledge that we have now, it makes it all that much better of an issue. It's because you see that he's operating on a different level than she is. You know what I mean? It's just a really good, and it shows her character as well, how much she cares about her people, but also how much Sinestro, beneath all of his bluster, cares about his people still.
Right.
So,
and it, you know, if you're viewing this story or Green Lantern Run through that Star Wars prism, clearly there's a lot of added implication there.
Oh, absolutely. And again, as we wrap it up here, no, this has never been about shocking you. This episode. This episode is all about why we love the Sinestro War, and I hope that's come through in the way that we've talked about it, because I told Nick this on the phone earlier today, that after rereading it, after the first time in a few years that I've read it, I honestly think it's his favorite superhero story arc. I mean, as I'm thinking about it, I mean, certainly there's things like The Long Halloween and Hush that have very strong sentimental value to me, or that work in different levels. But as far as a superhero action type comic book, I think this is my favorite story of all time. It holds up not just well, it holds up perfectly. It holds up to the point where there's nothing as I'm reading it that catches me weird, or that makes me think, I don't know if that holds up well, or what does that mean? Stuff like that. It's just a perfect superhero comic. And if you haven't ever read it, give it a shot. Even if you haven't read Green Lantern Rebirth, even if you haven't read Green Lantern Secret Origin, which if you haven't read those, go read those too. But even if you don't have the backstory of Geoff Johns' incredible Green Lantern run leading up to this, read this story and it'll make you want to go back and read everything that led into it. And it'll damn sure make you want to read everything that comes through.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I can't give this enough praise. I mean, this is something that if you call yourself a comics fan, especially if you call yourself a DC Comics fan, this has got to be in your collection. It is a must-own, regardless of the format you choose. I know Greg has the Absolute Edition. I read my I pulled out my giant Geoff Johns Green Lantern Omnibus Volume 1 and read through it that way. There are so many different
Both
ways.
Options. Yep.
Yeah, so many different ways to get your hands on this story. Really, not an excuse to not have this in your collection somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as an aside, if you want some, if you're wondering what some good companion stories might be, to give you a little background on some of these characters. Obviously, we mentioned Crisis on Infinite Earth to give you the background on the Anti-Monitor, Superboy Prime, Infinite Crisis, which was kind of a 20 years later sequel to Crisis on Infinite Earths, mm-hmm. The Death and Return of Superman. Well, actually, you can skip The Death of Superman. Just read Reign of the Superman, and that will give you the background on the Cyborg Superman.
Emerald Twilight and Green Lantern Rebirth both, I think.
Yep.
Because it gives you the full story of Parallax there if you read those two.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, the volumes of Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps leading into Sinestro Corps War would give you good background as well. And I'm trying to think if there's any others that may provide context. There's some little jokes here and there that reference some old Justice League stories that you could check out, but wouldn't say it's a Sinestro story.
Yeah,
but I recommend
when they reference a guy confronting his greatest fears, they ask him what it's all, and he's like, "I was in a coma and my girlfriend was dying." And that made me chuckle, even though it wasn't supposed to be funny.
Yeah, there is just a lot of nods in here for hardcore fans. Oh, and even though it's a book I've never read, Green Lantern Mosaic will give you some background to Jon Stewart's subplot throughout this story. So, so if you are interested in the backstory, if you've already read this, backwards to frontwards, give some of those stories a chance and see if they even accentuate your love of this story, and go back and read it again later. Because I think that's at the time that we originally read this, we were, at least for me, I was already 100% engrossed in the Green Lantern lore. Nick, when he first read it, he had never read a Green Lantern comic before in his life, and and I don't want you to speak for you, Nick, but I think it instantly engrossed you in the mythology and made you want to go back and absorb more of it.
definitely. I mean, I've told the story tons of times about how that, you know, I don't really want to get into it again, but that first issue, that Sinestro Corps special, that was the book that started it all for me with not really just the Green Lantern mythos, but kind of my deeper dive into the DC universe, you know, because prior to that, I was pretty much a Batman-only kind of guy. So, clearly, this book, you know, this story excited me in a way that, honestly, probably nothing has before.
Right. And, oh, well, before we end this part of the discussion, I also wanted to throw out a little bit, because you don't get to see a ton of the Justice League in the book, but they do show up, and they do play a factor as they battle the Sinestro Corps. There's what I thought was a nice little bit. Even in the midst of writing a Green Lantern book, Johns can't help but put his stamp on making sure that everybody knows who Superman is. And it's that bit where Cyborg Superman, Hank Henshaw, is fighting Superman, and he punches him through the Statue of Liberty and knocks off the Statue of Liberty's head, and he says, "You can't kill me." And Superman, but he says it in a way that's like angry that Superman can't kill him. And then Superman says, "Honestly, Henshaw, I've never tried." And it's kind of like that moment on Justice League Unlimited when he tells Darkseid that he's been holding back the whole time because he's afraid he'll hurt someone. So just another little great Jeff Johns thrown in there. So anyway, we love this story. You will love this story. If you've never read it, it's a modern classic. It's the linchpin of the Green Lantern mythology that we know and love today. The high water mark, I would say, even among several high water marks. So go and buy this however you need to and get your hands on it. So we hope you stick with us through the break, ladies and gentlemen. When we come back on the other side, we will have, of course, reading and watching. We will have the rundown, and we will have... hang on. It's coming through, Nick. What's that there going across the bottom of the screen? Oh, Ho-Ho Loon, still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment, as proven by a photo posted on Twitter this week.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. With Trips himself.
That's right. That's right. Well, there you have it, folks, your Ho-Ho Loon update. We'll be sure to continue updating you from the event center here in the future. But as it is, stay with us through the commercials. When we come back, we'll tell you what we thought about the week in television and the week in comics.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit clotheslines and headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The P PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favourite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second half of the long, weekly,
episodic
comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. That's right. We are back with the second half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and we're going to kick off with our weekly look at the news and notes from the world of comics, and you know what that means. That means it's time for...
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
Yes. It is time for the Rundown, folks. And
what? No. Self-aggrandizing. Oh, wonder who did that guitar riff there.
Unlike some of us, Mr. Duke, I don't like to sing my own praises. I don't like to toot my horn. I like to let the general public decide for themselves if the guy making guitar noises with his mouth in the background of the Rundown is the most talented individual currently alive, or the most talented individual to ever live. That's what I like to do, Nick. I leave it up to the listener.
The guitar noises. Greg, you've beaten it into the ground.
But then again, it's not for you to say.
And then again, that just made the list.
Well, we're going to get cracking with a world that is doing good for DC Comics, as opposed to some of its other outside of comics ventures. We're going to start on the world of television, where, as some of you may know, I believe we may have mentioned it once or twice here, the character of Black Lightning has gotten a pilot order at the CW. Now, originally, this was developed by Greg Berlanti of the CW universe for Fox, but Fox ended up passing on the pilot. But now it looks like CW is going to pick it up. Black Lightning is a character with a long and rich history with the Justice League, with the Outsiders. Very popular character back in the 70s and early 80s. And he is going to get a crack at joining the superhero lineup, it looks like, on the CW, as the CW gets closer and closer to being what it should be, in my opinion, which is the DC Network. Mm-hmm. And we're just getting closer to it. Nick, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this makes a lot of sense. Honestly, given the current track record of DC shows over on Fox, I am thankful this one's coming to the CW. This is the network that seems to know what to do and how to do it, and it adds another piece into that interconnected universe. Makes a lot of sense. And I think the character of Black Lightning, given the fact that that not too long ago we had a pretty successful, you know, Luke Cage series on Netflix, which we may or may not talk about later on in the show, hint, hint. I think this is the time for a character like Black Lightning. This is the time to inject the DC universe with a little bit of diversity. And I think this has some potential.
And not to inject it with a lethal dose of poison.
Mm.
That just made the list. Mm-hmm. Well, while that's going great, and I agree with everything you said, Nick, it just seems like a natural fit. If you're going to do a DC show, might as well put it on the CW at this point. Although I take that back if they ever do a Green Lantern show, because that needs to be in only the highest budget scenario. But
yeah, I know. What are you thinking of, like an HBO Green Lantern show?
Yes. Well, to take the place of Game of Thrones whenever that ends.
I'm not going to hold my breath on that one, but it would be awesome.
No. But in any event, we mentioned, or I mentioned just a few minutes ago, that the TV world is going great for DC right now. Well, regardless of the fan you are of the movies, there's no doubt that the movie slate for DC is somewhat of a convoluted situation. Right,
somewhat
now.
Of a situation.
That's a much better way of putting it. I don't know why I didn't just lead off with that. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Somewhat of a unique situation, quite frankly. And an interesting article is out right now on Forbes that I would recommend Googling. Mark Hughes is the author. He's been a longtime champion of the DC properties. He even liked Suicide Squad. So while I don't agree with him a lot as a movie critic and in his opinions and stuff like that, he is incredibly knowledgeable about the DC cinematic universe. He has sources within Warner Brothers. He's broken a lot of stories in the past.
And he's been one of the few writers who seemingly has no interest in taking shots at DC. He seemingly seems to be a professional journalist who is also simultaneously something of a cheerleader for this slate of films. So, you know, you can debate for yourself whether or not that's a good thing ultimately for a supposedly impartial, unbiased, reporter to be taking. But the point is, this is not somebody who is pulling for the DCEU to fail.
Right, as it seems that some are in the landscape. And as a result, when he weighs in on the DC Cinematic Universe, it holds some weight. And he has a great up right now, delving into a lot of the panic behind the in the fan base about the Ben Affleck departure as director of the seemingly upcoming Batman movie. And that departure definitely set off panic fandom. Even I, who have been unabashedly excited about the Batman project for so long, now I am not really sure what to think about it. And he had a great article that kind of took that and kind of put it into some perspective and talked about what's going on, what could go on, what is likely to go on, and what the ramifications could be. And we learned a few things from it. First of all, that the script is getting has gotten a rewrite already, and that there's talk that they may even from scratch whenever they get a new director on board.
Yeah, basically, I think the thought is that once a new director is hired, that director would then have the ability to either keep the script as is, or they would have the latitude to rewrite if they so chose.
Right. So, in any event, the upshot of it all is that the project is almost assuredly going to be pushed back to 2019, which, of course, will be a major milestone for the character of Batman. That will be the – let me make sure I've got my math right here. That will be the 80th anniversary of Batman. Is that correct, Nick?
1929, so 90th, I believe.
39. No, 39.
Yeah, so – wait a minute.
39,
you're right. Yeah, you're right. So, 80th, yes.
So, that got pushed back. However, there's also, and he's written about this as well, even though he says that it's unlikely, he says that there have been, he seems to be hinting around at the possibility that Ben Affleck could, after Justice League's over, just decide to walk away from the cowl to no longer play Batman. So, we don't know if that's going to happen or not. But this is something that's been talked about, and in any event, I don't know who is in charge of WB's PR right now, but this guy makes a great point that they need to be getting out in front of this and be honest with people about what's going on. You don't have to reveal contract details and all that stuff, but just be honest with people what the state is of these movies, because as it is right now, they just continue to take PR hit after PR hit, because they've given the fan base no reason to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. You know, as I've said many times, you know, after Suicide Squad, which was really the one that burned me the biggest, because I was very much looking forward to that one, and mm-hmm. the somewhat underwhelming response to the theatrical Batman Superman cut, you know, they have lost that benefit of the doubt with me. And stories like this, you know, I want to be a blind believer in everything that DC is doing, but they've given me no reason to do so, you know, at this point. And you read stories like this, or you read stories like the report that came out a few weeks back that, admittedly, it's likely bullshit, but would you really be that surprised if Wonder Woman is a mess, like the report said? I know that I wouldn't be at this point. I mean, every little bit that comes out seems to be so negative, whether it's developments or lack thereof with The Flash, that little Wonder Woman snippet we heard, or pretty much everything about this Batman project. At this point, Greg, I'm going to be honest. I wouldn't be surprised if Affleck walked away. And
at this point, I wouldn't. No, I mean, I'm not saying I think he will.
No,
I'm just saying
I wouldn't be surprised.
Same thing with Wonder Woman. I think Wonder Woman will be good. Will I be surprised if it sucks? Absolutely not.
No, yeah, and I think from Affleck's perspective, you kind of got to look at it like this. This is a dude who took a lot of grief for a long time during the middle part of his career, and he worked really hard to gain that critical acclaim and to, you know, to remove some of the tarnish from his name. And if I'm him, you start looking at it and you're like, what is the risk? I mean, what is the reward for this risk I'm taking? Like, why not just cut your losses at this point and move on and make films that seem to be a little bit better received and continue your status as one of the A-list directors and producers in all of Hollywood? I mean, because, you know, Kevin Smith said this on a recent podcast, and I kind of agree. The expectation at this point for a Ben Affleck-directed Batman movie is, oh man, that should be the best Batman movie of all time. But wasn't the best Batman movie of all time already kind of made? And if the standard now is The Dark Knight, the odds of topping that are so incredibly low. I don't understand. Oh, that I see the payoff, so to speak.
Right, and you know, who knows? It's unfair for fandom to hold every subsequent Batman movie up to the standard of The Dark Knight, but it happens. Even with Nolan.
Yeah.
Even with Dark Knight Rises, we'll hold against that it wasn't The Dark Knight. So, you know, we'll see where this all goes. But related to that, also according to Forbes, there's another new short list of directors to replace Ben Affleck as director of the Batman.
One other thing we should mention, though, before we jump into the list of directors, though, Greg, is one thing that Forbes article also revealed is that part of the reason that Affleck stepped away is because Warner Brothers was actually pressuring him to delay all his non-DC related projects. And this goes back as far as, you know, Live by Night, which recently came out. Apparently back after Affleck was first cast as Batman, the pressure began then to pretty much indefinitely put his career on hold and only do DC films for the foreseeable future. And clearly Affleck is a guy at this point whose creative freedom is very important to him, so I can't imagine that the pressure from the studio to only do this one thing was helping very much to make their case for him to be a director.
Right, and you got to understand the pressure that puts on a guy to stay in Batman shape and to put off your personal, you know, pet projects that you want to work on, and while you're having personal problems, his own life, dealing with his marriage and things like that, a lot of stuff for anybody to handle. Also, it revealed in that Forbes article is that Warner Brothers is considering scrapping the Batman in favor of a Jake and the Fat Man reboot movie. So, I thought that was interesting as well. But let's move on to that list of directors. We mentioned last week Matt Reeves of War of the Planet of the Apes and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes fame. He's kind of considered the front runner right now, but additionally banded about include Gavin O'Connor, who directed The Accountant, which was a really good Ben Affleck action flick from October.
Oh, so you saw it?
I did. I watched it a couple weekends ago. Yep. Really liked it.
Yeah, I would assume that the draw, you know, I don't know much about Gavin O'Connor, but I would assume that the idea of him being on a short list is, I would guess, related to his pre-existing working relationship with Affleck, and that could be a draw for Affleck to stay on the movie. I mean, just spitballing there.
Yeah, probably so. And he did a really good job, I thought, with The Accountant. A nice action film. He also directed Warrior, which I've never seen, but was supposedly a good MMA movie, which I never thought would be made. So that's good. Certainly. Also on the list, Denis Villeneuve, who directed Arrival, a movie that is being considered for lots of awards that I haven't seen, but many people I trust said it was one of the best movies of the year.
Also directed, Greg, one of you and a recent favorite of ours, Prisoners, that came out a couple years back.
Yes.
So, I mean, not to tell tales out of skewl, but of this short list, he is by far and away my preferred choice, if there's any validity to this.
Right. And then we've got a guy named Matt Ross, who, frankly, I don't know much about. I really don't know a whole lot about him. But he is on the list. Not Jared's list, by the way, but
just not Jennifer's list. Just, you know, a separate list.
A separate, unrelated list. So I hope he doesn't get it. And George Miller, of course, his name always seems to come up in these. I would consider that one highly unlikely. But you never know. I know that they had, you know, there was talks of Armie Hammer who has a ridiculous name, by the way, meeting with Geoff Johns, and Armie Hammer was originally play Batman in George Miller's Justice League movie back in the day, so who knows. But I don't consider that one to be very likely. So of the short list directors, I think we both agree that Villeneuve would be our preferred dude out of those.
Absolutely. Prisoners, for those of you who have not seen it, is one of the most endlessly bleak and depressing movies that I absolutely love that I've ever seen. I highly recommend it to anyone who has even the slightest interest in revenge thrillers that take drastically dark turns.
It is very difficult to watch, but I mean that I don't mean that in a negative way necessarily. It's a difficult movie to watch, but it's a very, very good movie. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, let's go from the big screen to the small screen.
Absolutely.
Actually, not the small screen.
Yeah, let's go to the small screen.
Oh, well, tell people what we got for them.
All right, so not really much of a story here, but this past week, the good folks over at Marvel and Netflix dropped on us the latest trailer for Iron Fist, or Arn Fist, if you will. Got a release date that is now coming. I believe it is March 14th, but I am I'm not positive about that. Let me use the Google machine here. March 17th, Iron Fist will be dropping on Netflix, of course, all at once in big format, much like the other Marvel Netflix shows. So just kind of wanted to discuss, you know, our general reactions to the trailer. I liked the trailer. I didn't love it. I liked it. Greg?
I would say about the same. I liked it a lot. I you know, as many people who know us have understand, Iron Fist is actually the Marvel Netflix show that I've been most anticipating.
Despite the fact that you've never read an Iron Fist comic.
Never read an Iron Fist comic in my life. But I know the general concept of Iron Fist was built into the Kung Fu phase of the 70s. He was one of Marvel's Kung Fu karate characters, basically. And as somebody that grew up on a steady diet of martial arts films and action films, I mean, action films are my favorite genre of movie. I just love them. Even the bad ones, I love them. And I was hoping for something not unlike Into the Badlands that kind of would satiate my love for complex, it could be over the top or it could be gritty, but probably complex, you know, Hong Kong style fight scenes. And that's kind of why I've been so excited about Iron Fist, something that would embrace culture and show, that side of the Marvel universe, that, you know, that side occupied by Shang-Chi and Iron Fist and people like that. So really excited for it. And the trailer was very, very good. But it's weird that I'm now that we're getting closer to it, I'm not quite as pumped up for it as I have been. And it's not, no knock on the trailer. It was very good. But it did seem very reminiscent of Arrow, the pilot episode of Arrow, and also Batman Begins, which Arrow itself was reminiscent of in the pilot episode. Which is fine.
For the record, there are worse things to rip off than Batman Begins.
No, absolutely, it's great. But I don't know. It didn't strike me with its originality. I'll put it that way. And that's again, that's fine. We've seen it a million times. I mean, Doctor Strange had a lot of elements from Batman Begins.
Yeah, Doctor Strange was very Batman Begins crossed with Inception. Which again,
yes.
If you're going to borrow from someone, no one's the guy to borrow from, in my opinion.
But you know, it didn't leave me cold necessarily. I still was like, okay, that's going to be really cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it didn't light me on fire the way that necessarily the Luke Cage trailer did when it first dropped. Mm-hmm. And then the other aspect is still waiting to buy into this guy as Danny Rand. I have to see him more in action. And I think – and it's very, very, very shallow to say. And I know it doesn't ultimately matter. And it really won't matter. If he delivers as an actor, it'll be fine. Because at this point, it's kind of like the people that complained about Hugh Jackman's Wolverine when he was first cast, that he wasn't short enough, you know. But I will say this. He doesn't – the guy playing Iron Fist doesn't seem to necessarily have the physique that I've always thought Iron Fist would have, which is kind of like I always imagined to be kind of built like Bruce Lee, even though he's a Caucasian, but being built like Bruce Lee, having that lean musculature to him. And I don't really know if this guy has that yet. But, you know, ultimately it won't matter if he delivers in the acting department and if he can deliver the scenes. So I am still really looking forward to this.
Yeah, one little touch I liked was the fact that they had the Iron Fist logo as like a tattoo on his chest rather than some sort of symbol he was going to wear on a uniform of any sort. So I liked that little nod to it.
Yep, and I also love when you see the actual Iron Fist get lit up at the end of the trailer. That was the best moment. That was really cool. So definitely looking forward to that.
It does look very much, though, like they have really stepped up the abilities of each of these heroes as we go forward. You know, once you finally watch Luke Cage, Greg, you'll see, like, I'm very intrigued to see what the threat is in the Defenders that could possibly, you know, test essentially Jessica Jones, who has super strength and some form of invulnerability, Luke Cage, who in his series is portrayed like a freaking human tank, and then, of course, Iron Fist is shown to have the ability to basically level entire, you know, floors of buildings and whatnot. So I'm very intrigued to see how they handle the increasing introduction of superpowers into their street-level universe.
And, of course, Daredevil, who can't see, and, of course, Karen Page, who can lecture anyone about how they're doing things wrong. So.
Well, she shares that in common with a certain other female character who we may or may not talk about in just a little
bit. Absolutely. So, moving right along. Let's go down to the printed page and talk about a couple of comics coming your way from Marvel. First of all, we have gotten confirmation that there's a brand new Luke Cage solo series coming from writer David Walker and artist Nelson Blake II, which is a great name. Actually sounds like a Watchmen character. This is going to be a quote, street hero take on Luke Cage, which is great. I mean, that's the way to do him, in my opinion. It's described as a more contemplative take on the character, looking to balance the stories from recent comic books as well as the live-action Netflix series. And I've never read a Luke Cage solo comic or much of Luke Cage in general in the comics, but I'd be interested in giving this one a crack once it goes on Marvel Unlimited. Nick, your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I'll be very interested to see how much, especially this ties into the current Jessica Jones ongoing, because David Walker, the writer, gives a very telling quote here in this story that we're reading on Newsroom, where he says, Luke is essentially a private detective. He's a private detective who also happens to be a superhero. Maybe he's more of a superhero first than he is a private detective, as opposed to his wife, who is more of a detective than she is a superhero. The implication there being that the marriage to Jessica Jones still remains intact, despite current struggles they are going through for Jessica Jones' solo title. So that gives me a little bit of hope. So if it has a lot of crossover with the Jessica Jones solo title, I think I'll be in some way, shape, form, or fashion, whether that be Marvel Unlimited or possibly, you know, picking up the trade or whatever. So certainly interested.
Very good. And I understand, Nick, that there's also another Marvel that caught your eye.
Yeah, there is. You know, as those of you who have listened to the podcast for a while know, I am currently a voracious reader of both the current main Star Wars title and the Dr. Aphra ongoing title. And it was recently announced that that we are going to have another Star Wars crossover event, much like Vader Down that preceded it, which was a crossover between the Star Wars title and the then Darth Vader solo title. This will be a crossover between Star Wars and Dr. Aphra, known as the Screaming Citadel. And it's being described as something of a horror story set in the Star Wars universe. Jason Aaron, in particular, who is the writer of the main Star Wars title, frames it as a gothic horror story. And apparently it's going to very much focus on Aphra and Luke interacting and what the heck is, which only lends credence to my unlikely hope that Aphra will ultimately be revealed to be the mother of one Rey in the film universe. That is never going to happen, but it can't stop me from shipping the hell out of it.
Very good. Well, certainly Dr. Aphra was one of the standouts of the Darth Vader book that we read a few months ago. So looking forward to that.
And the thing to remember is wherever Aphra goes, 000 and BT can't be far behind.
That's right. Two other standouts of the Darth Vader book. So should be a fun ride for fans of Marvel's Star Wars. Well, that brings an end to our rundown for the week. Certainly, we will keep you updated as the more concrete information comes out about the DC Cinematic Universe. Right now, it looks like Aquaman is going pretty well, so hopefully that will continue to happen. We'll update you on that as well when we get more information. Let you know about all the goings-on in the world of comics as it comes to us. But for now, let's turn over to the longest-running segment on the longest-running Weekly About a Comic Book podcast. That's right, folks. Let's head to
Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Oh, and there's just no voice quite like that to get me ready to talk about comics and TV, Nick.
Absolutely, I agree.
Well, this week we're going to kick things off with what you're reading, and I actually did read some comics this week in addition to the Sinestro Corps War. So had a good little. In full disclosure, we're recording the show about 2 days later in the week than we usually do, due to real life circumstances, and so as a result, I had a little bit more time to read stuff this time around. I got to read Sinestro Corps War, and I got to read some single issues comics. So I'm back in the fold to do top three and bottom one. So, Nick, do you want to get us started with
I want you to get us started since you bowed out entirely last week.
Oh, since I bowed out entirely last week, huh?
Yep.
Oh, that's real cute.
Yep.
That's real, quite frankly, real cute.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Dan. Well, I will get us started with my number three book of the time period. What is that number three book of the time period, you ask? I'll be happy to answer that for you. That number three book of the time period is Nightwing 8, the conclusion of the Rise of Raptor story arc. And again, as is often a disclaimer on this show, this is a book that came out long, long, long ago, several months ago. I thought this was a good issue of Nightwing. I thought this was perhaps the best issue of Nightwing that I've read in the Rebirth run. It's a book that, quite frankly, again, there's that word again, frankly, and quite before it. It's a book that I haven't really been that thrilled about. I don't talk about it much because it's just kind of there. It's not bad. It's just, usually it's just kind of there for me. But this one I thought was good. This was a rare comic, and I have to admit, Nick, that this made my list largely because I'm a sucker for the concept, because it's a rare comic, maybe the only comic that I can remember, at least in many, 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 many years, where Dick Grayson has to save Bruce Wayne. And I really I enjoyed it. I'm not going to lie. I got some sort of perverse pleasure out of seeing Nightwing be the one to ultimately save Batman at the end, after battling this new villain, Raptor, or updated version of an old Nightwing villain, Raptor. And I do like this updated take on Raptor and how they tie him into Dick Grayson's childhood. Maybe not the best backstory, but at least it's better than they could have. Because oftentimes I don't like it when they try to invent new characters from Dick's childhood that he didn't remember until just now. But it worked with Hush for Batman, and it sort of kind of worked with Raptor here. Raptor's a compelling character. Dick finally gets to kick his ass. And then, in the end, saves Bruce. And then Bruce has this line where, at the very end of this issue, Nightwing says, "He almost killed you, Bruce. You fell." And then Bruce reveals to Dick, he says, "I didn't fall. I jumped. I jumped because I knew you'd catch me." And that's where the book ends. And really, really dug it.
Awesome. Good to hear. Moving on to my number three book of the week, I'm going to go with Green Arrow number 16. This is the latest installment in the Emerald Outlaw storyline. This features the full-time return of Emiko Queen to the title. It also features a big showdown between Oliver and this militaristic rogue police force known as the Vice Squad. And also increasing interactions between Oliver and this new ally on the police force, who I really like the dynamic here. So, loved pretty much everything about it, and it seems like Percy was itching to get Emiko back, because he writes the Emiko and Oliver dynamic in this issue better than he did probably in the entire initial storyline of this title. So, loved the hell out of Green Arrow number 16.
Excellent. And I also want to mention the creative team on Nightwing on this issue was Tim Seeley and Javier Fernandez. So, I want to give them some shout-out there. My number two book of the time period is Titans number 5 by Dan Abnett and Brett Booth. This was a stellar issue. This was all about Wally West trying to see if he can save all of his friends and the love of his life in 6 seconds. The villain Abracadabra has kind of put him in this precarious position where he's got only a handful of seconds to go across the tree, save all of the Titans, and save Linda Park, and kind of prove whether he can do it. And the whole issue, we're inside Wally's head as he's trying to do this, and we know what he feels, we know why he's doing this, and I think it's Brett Booth's best issue from an art perspective of Titans, and I think that it is another outstanding issue of this series. Dan Abnett has a great voice for Wally West, and has done a wonderful job of reintroducing Wally to the DC universe. So highly recommend picking up the Titans trade whenever it comes out.
Awesome. My number two book of the week is Batman number 16. This is part one of the I Am Bane storyline. First of all, love this because they kind of return Bane to a more of a hulking terror lurking behind the scenes. We don't really see Bane very much in this book, but his presence is felt throughout, and it really feels like they're ramping up the threat level that represents to Batman and the entire Bat family. But mainly this book makes my list for the outstanding character interactions between both Bruce and the other members of the Batman family, specifically Dick, Damian, Jason, and Duke Thomas. An outstanding little scene at a Batman-themed fast food restaurant that is absolutely hilarious to see the various ways that Bruce reacts to everything going on around him. But also, this can, to, in my opinion, nail the Batman-Catwoman dynamic. Even putting Batman in an uncomfortable position of having to choose between his loyalty to Catwoman and his loyalty to Jim Gordon. And I think, Greg, you will enjoy the way he chooses to handle the situation when you get there. So, loving Batman as we go forward.
Excellent. I'm really pumped to read that now. I mentioned it before, but he's kind of drawn me back in. He's kind of drawn me back in as Tom King. So looking forward to seeing what they've got coming next. And appropriately enough for this episode, my number one issue that I've read in the last week was Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 9, the second chapter of the Bottled Light storyline. We mentioned that the Sinestro Corps War is the greatest Green Lantern story of them all. And as a result of that, everything that's come after Geoff Johns left, when he finished, the Sinestro Corps War was part of this, the giant, the overarching 10-year run of John's and was part of this giant story he was telling, the War of the Light and all that. Since then, nothing's really been able to measure up. And while I won't go so far as to say that this current run, Howard and the Green Lantern Corps, measures up necessarily to Sinestro Corps War, Blackest Night, Rebirth era, I will say this, it's the closest that we've seen to it. It's actually taking a lot of the beats and a lot of the ideas from Sinestro Corps War and kind of reintroducing them through the core. And it's been awesome. It's been absolutely awesome, even to the point of this is the issue that reintroduces Ganthet and Sayid to readers. First time we've seen them in a long time. Hal goes into the land of the Fallen Lanterns and meets Abin Sur. It's just a wonderful issue. Gardner being Guy Gardner, John Stewart being the natural leader of the Corps that he is, Sorenik trying to prove her worth. Great issue of a great ongoing series that I have to say, Nick, is rapidly rising up my list of favorite Rebirth titles.
Absolutely. Glad to hear that. And while we're speaking about favorite titles, let me talk about one that has regularly found its way onto the top spot of my list, but is not going to be there for much longer because it's sadly coming to an end. And so my number one book of the week is Old Man Logan 17. This is essentially the Old Man Logan that we know and love crossed with a little bit of the 1979 Alien movie in terms of a very atmospheric, claustrophobic, tense horror concept that is rendered in expert fashion by the greatest artist today, Andrea Sorrentino. Not to mention the fact that we also play with the idea of Logan experiencing multiple realities at once, which is to say both experiencing his future past of the Wastelands and current space-focused storyline at once and not being able to distinguish which is real and which is a figment of his imagination. It is a really, really innovative comic in the way it's laid out, the way it's written, the way it's drawn. I love the hell out of this series, and I'm going to be so sad to see it go when it finally wraps up. And for those longtime X-Men fans, and especially fans of Alpha Flight, you also have Puck along for the ride as a supporting character here, which I know would make a lot of people happy.
Gotta love Puck. Gotta love Puck. That's awesome, man. I'm happy to hear that book is back to being awesome again after I know a couple of issues that you were underwhelmed by. So,
well, those were issues that didn't have Andrea Sorrentino.
Right. That is the ultimate factor there. On to our bottom book of the week, and this is full disclosure, I'm not going to have really anything bad to say about my bottom book of the week. It was a good issue. It only made it just by process of elimination because it let me cop out and not have one. So, I am going to go with Nightwing number 9 by Tim Seeley and the artist named Takara. I don't know his or her first. It's Marcio Takara is the artist. This is actually a fine comic. There's nothing wrong with it at all. It's not, I don't think it's great, but it does introduce some cool stuff. It introduces the new version of the Dr. Destiny, if you remember, from the Justice League episode. They got a new version of him. And there's a great bit, it seems like the writers are having fun kind of poking fun at the New 52 a little bit throughout. There's a great line in here where Dick is talking about this new Dr. Destiny and he shows – and Superman actually, who as you know is the only character other than Wally West that remembers the pre-Rebirth or pre-New 52 version of the DC Universe. So Superman grabs Dick and brings him to his fortress because he realizes that Dr. Destiny is there. And he's like he's showing Dick's wall of information that he has about potential threats from his world that may be crossing over. And he shows Dick the original Dr. Destiny, who kind of looks like Skeletor. And so Dick says, "Your world's version is significantly less disturbing looking than the guy I just saw." And then Superman goes, "That's a common thread I've noticed with your Earth." So a nice little shot there at the New 52. And in addition, there's on that – I thought you might find this, Nick. On that wall of threats, you see visual representations of Doomsday, the Sun Eater, Neron, and Superman Prime.
Oh, yes. Give it to me. Give it to me. Well,
so, yep. So I don't have bad to say about this. I will say the art is okay. It's not great, but it's okay. And the overall usage of Dr. Destiny was a little underwhelming. But other than that, gushy.
Yeah, and speaking of Superman, my bottom book of the week is Superman number 16. But much like Greg, I don't really have much bad to say about it. This is the finale of the Multiplicity storyline that is just a crazy, over-the-top, zany, Silver Age-style Superman story. Update modern context. I enjoyed it for the goofy thing that it was, including, like, Superman using some sort of intergalactic music box as a beacon to alert others to his location and stuff. So just lots of Silver Age Superman hilarity here, but not done in the Grant Morrison lens, which is really all you can hope for. So a fine comic, but ultimately the weakest of the ones that I read this week.
Understood. Well, hit us with your quick hits, Nick, because I ain't got none.
Sure. Green Lantern 16 gives us finally the Simon, Jessica, and Batman team up we have wanted pretty much since Simon and Jessica really hit their stride after the initial storyline in Green Lanterns. I didn't love the dynamic here. I think Humphreys writes Batman weird. Like, he refers to both Simon and Jessica as just Lantern rather than, you know, any sort of, you know, distinctive names. And just the entire tone treats Batman more like the aggressive dick version of Batman that we knew from back around the time of Infinite Crisis, as opposed to the more positive Batman that's been featured in Rebirth thus far. But ultimately, a fine issue.
Hey, that reminds me of something, Nick.
Yeah.
If Nightwing opened up his food restaurant and served French fries, would they be dictators?
Yes, absolutely they would be dictators. Or they probably wouldn't be, because he wouldn't want to give away his real name, you know, in the...
Oh, good point.
In the fast food restaurant. Anyway,
they'd be penis taters.
Penis taters, exactly. Aquaman number 16. This is kind of a little interlude issue that deals with the fallout of the deluge. So, liked this one. Liked to get to see Arthur and Mira interact and just kind of have a conversation for the first time in a while. And also the woman character from back in Amnesty Bay that I forget the name of. We get to see her back around doing stuff, and she kind of reveals at one point that she used to have a crush on Arthur, and Arthur's like, "Oh, I didn't know that." And she kind of, and then she goes, "Yes, and now we should stop talking before your fiance kills me." And they end the conversation at that point. moving on, Star Wars.
I just assume that every female character in the Aquaman comics has a crush on Arthur.
Yes, and they all are deathly afraid of Mira, I would assume.
Yep.
As they should be. Moving on to my final quick hit of the week. This one just missed my top three. Star Wars number 28 continues the story within a story within a story they are telling here. So we kind of get three different levels of this one. We have a current-day framing sequence of Luke looking back at Obi-Wan relating a past-day story of Yoda in his diary. Yes, a bit convoluted, but it ultimately serves the purpose to kind of show how each of these Jedi at various points in their path, various points in their journey, are reacting to situations around them, and kind of highlights the commonalities between them, but also the differences between them, and how each of them has their own strengths and weaknesses. So while it's mostly focused on Yoda, I absolutely loved each of the framing sequences that we got as well. So loving this one, can't wait to see how they wrap this storyline up as they get ready to head into the Screaming Citadel crossover. And that's my quick hits.
Nick, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Where have you been?
Oh, I was sojourning to the antimatter universe to consult with Quardians for my ring. But
if you have to take a piss next time, just let us know.
No. It wasn't that. It wasn't anything like that. I assure you, it was antimatter related. But in any event, that brings an end to the quick hits. And as you all know, ladies and gentlemen, that only means one thing. What does that mean? That the quick hits are over. The other thing that it means, though, is that it's time for what you're watching. And as has been the case almost every week we've been doing this podcast, we've been watching the CWDC shows.
Yep.
That's what we've been watching.
Our stories.
Our stories. That's right. That's what they are. They are our stories. And let's kick things off, I guess, on Monday with Supergirl. Goodness gracious, Nick. What happened on Supergirl last week?
Well, the episode mostly focused around a subplot of James Olsen being jealous of Kara's affection for Mon-El and her willingness to allow him to assist with superheroics, but her hesitance to allow he and Wynn to be out on the streets and stuff. So basically, it was a very James Olsen-focused episode, which means that it was an exceedingly boring episode.
Yeah, which boring and James Olsen tend to go hand in hand, do they not?
They do. They absolutely do. They are two bad tastes that taste bad together.
That's right. It was a another lackluster episode in what to me has been a stretch of pretty lackluster episodes. There was the really good scene between John and McGann that took place where they kind of bonded together in McGann's mind. Now, I will say I wondered why they were in human form and not mine instead of their natural Martian forms, but I'm assuming that was CGI related and probably for the best.
Well, so and just... also from McGann's character standpoint, it makes a little sense because she ultimately is trying to reject her true form. You know?
That's true.
It makes less sense from John's perspective, I suppose.
Yeah, but I think ultimately it was for the best for the episode. The actors did really well. That was the highlight of the entire episode. Obviously, Mon-El is great, but holy crap, what was up with Kara's characterization in this episode? I mean, she was acting like a flat-out bitch to everyone around her. She was mean to Mon-El. She was mean to James and Wynn. She was mean. She was just not acting the way that she normally acts. It was very strange writing on their part, I thought. It was just not a strong episode in any sense of the word. Also, this generic mad scientist character, not compelling.
I would tend to agree with that.
All right. Well, that sets us up for
The Flash.
The Flash on Tuesday. That's right. And this, Nick, tell the folks what The Flash was about last week, because I have since watched the newer episode, and I'm trying to remember what
Greg,
that one was.
Greg is using me to jog his aging memory, so I will remind him that last week's Flash focused heavily on Cisco and the character of Gypsy coming over from...
That's right.
What Earth have we designated Earth, for HR?
Earth...
30. I want to say something in the 30s, but... The designation is not
19?
Important.
19? I don't know.
Yeah, the Gypsy comes over from HR's Earth, and basically it is revealed that interdimensional travel has been banned on that planet that universe as a
Also, Earth's... did you say I have an Asian mind?
Aged, Greg.
Oh, okay. I understand now. I was going to say, that's probably offensive to some people. I'm sure that nobody that is of Asian descent wants to be compared to me.
I would probably agree with that. In any event...
Wait a minute.
In any event, the episode focuses around the idea that HR has violated their laws and is going to be brought back to their Earth to be put to death. And the only way to free it is to defeat this Gypsy character in a trial by combat. Now you would think to yourself, well, doesn't it make sense for Barry to challenge her to a trial by combat? No, we're going to do Cisco. And so we get a admittedly pretty funny comedy base that features Barry and HR trying to train Cisco for this fight he's going to have with Gypsy, and you know it's all pretty entertaining, honestly.
Yeah, they do a pretty crappy job of training him. Actually, this is not the magical training Cisco, and he really gets it right off the bat. You know, they don't do a very good job of encouraging him because Barry is feeding him just pie in the sky beliefs, and HR is the whole time just completely writing him off. So, yeah. Definitely agree. This was a fun episode, entertaining, funny, and really showed the Flash for its strongest point, which is its characters and the interactions between those characters, whether it was HR and Cisco, whether it was Barry and Joe, Barry and Iris. Iris and Joe. There were just phenomenal moments between this incredible cast they've got put together. And I'm going to go ahead and say it, Nick. I'm worried about losing a major cast member this season, I'm worried that it may be Joe.
Yep, I am worried that they're tinkering with the timeline because Barry hasn't learned anything is going to wind up resulting in Joe's death as opposed to Iris's, and that would suck.
Yep, I am really hoping that doesn't happen because honestly, of all the shows, I've said before, Arrow has three characters that it can't lose: Oliver, Felicity, and Diggle. Legends probably has three characters that it can't lose: Sarah, Ray, and Mick. The Flash, I don't think, can lose any of the main players at this point. It's a great, great cast. You could maybe lose Julian, you know, some of the people on
although,
the side.
Although, they could pull and just bring in lounge singer Joe from Earth 2 next season.
Ooh!
Who just runs around singing Barry life advice.
And since we always have to have a new Wells in each season, maybe with Cowboy Wells and singing Joe.
And lounge singer Joe, yeah, I kind of like that.
To team up together. What if they sang a song
together? That just made the list.
Excellent.
And that should be moved to the top of the list, by the way, for YouTube research. Rock,
absolutely.
Stone Cold, Sing, enter that on YouTube. You will not be disappointed.
Yep. Watch it and love it.
Absolutely.
To quote Paul Heyman, this is surreal. in any event, let's move on to, spoiler alert, what I thought was the episode of the week. Legends of Tomorrow, which is on a roll right now, mm-hmm, Nick. Mm-hmm. This was yet another outstanding episode in a series of them on this show that featured a subplot involving Stein and his daughter, which was really cool, but the main reason this episode was so awesome is that it took place almost entirely from the villain's perspective. Mm-hmm. This was a Damian Dark and Reverse Flash and Malcolm Merlyn team-up episode.
To include even having the opening narrator in the show of the episode that all the CW shows are kind of known for at this point, that opening narration is delivered by Damian Dark. Was it Damian Dark or was it Malcolm Merlyn? I can't remember.
It was Damian Dark.
Yeah, by Dark. And kind of frames you're about to see in the entire episode as this is the story of these villains and what they're up to right now. So I love the hell out of it as well.
And it's so weird because, as you know, I enjoy – Damian Dark was the element of the last season of Arrow I enjoyed the most. But his interactions with Malcolm Merlyn were never that great on Arrow. They were just kind of – you know, Malcolm was almost kind of like an underling to him. But this last 2 weeks of Legends of Tomorrow – have created one of the most unlikely, amazing comedic duos between Malcolm Merlyn and Dark. They are great together.
Right. What I would say about Damian Dark and Arrow last season is that the performance was good enough to elevate what was most of the time pretty substandard material. Here you are marrying the fantastic performance by Neil McDonough with much improved material from his previous appearances on Arrow. And it kind of creates this whole new dynamic and a whole comedic side of this character that we didn't really get to see in what was ultimately a severely underwhelming season last year.
Right. And, of course, the always stellar John Barrowman as Malcolm Merlyn. Just they are so good together. That scene where they were talking to each other and Malcolm is talking a big game to Damian and talking about how he's intimidated by him, and then when Damian walks away, the camera cuts behind Malcolm and it shows that he's been holding a knife the entire time. Because he was afraid of Damian Dark, that he was going to attack him. And then they have that sword fight in front of Rip Hunter, which is a great scene. Amazing episode and some of the best scenes ever on Legends of Tomorrow. Scenes between the three bad guys, but especially Malcolm and Damian, and how they kind of end up turning the tables on the Reverse Flash and forcing to view them as equals. So, really good.
Absolutely. And then, of course, that brings us to the final DC CW show of the week, which was Arrow, and this was an episode entirely focused on the search for the new Black Canary. And so, Greg, tell the people a little bit about this new and kind of how she interacts with Team Arrow throughout this episode.
Right. Well, this new, you know, the new woman that they've picked out to become Black Canary is a former Central City police officer who went undercover, as we learned at the beginning of this episode. And her cover gets blown. Her husband gets murdered before her very eyes, right as the particle accelerator from the original Harrison Wells blows up and grants her with the power or the curse, however you want to put it, the sonic scream that we all know from Black Canary from the comics. So she is a metahuman.
Right.
Unlike
not a technology based right. version of the Sonic Scream, like Laurel and Sarah.
Right. So she is a metahuman with the ability of the Sonic Scream, and she is out for revenge when we first meet her in this episode. She wants to get revenge on the drug dealers that murdered her husband, a la RoboCop, one of my favorite movies of all time. So she's out to get revenge on these bad guys by any means necessary. And meanwhile, Team Arrow is trying to convince Oliver about different candidates to become the new Black Canary, but he says none of them feel right, that the Black Canary is... it's going to have to feel right in order for it to happen. He liked the idea of this one. So he and the team go to Hub City, where she's staying, which longtime DC fans may recognize Hub City as the hometown of the Question, Vic Sage. Particularly, you know, I'm primarily familiar with it through the Neo-Neil era of the Question. But this is the home location of the Question, who doesn't appear in the episode, but I suspect may appear on Arrow in the future. So, they go to Hub City to track down this new Black Canary, whose name that they give her at the beginning of the episode, I can't remember, but we end up finding out...
it was Tina Boland, that sounds right.
Something like that. And then we find out at the end of the episode, Nick, that this real first name is Dinah, and her real last name is Drake. Which is the name of the original Black Canary from the comics in the Golden Age.
The original Golden Age Black Canary. And I will say, in this one episode, because I haven't watched the subsequent episodes of Arrow yet, but I will say this, and this is coming from someone who very enjoyed Sarah Lance as this version of the Black Canary, but someone who also pretty much hated Laurel Lance as that version of the Black Canary.
Mm-hmm.
To me, in this one episode, this Dynamite character already feels more like the Black Canary that I know and love from the comics, specifically from the Mike Grell run on Green Arrow, than any version of Black Canary that the DC CW universe has put forth on screen thus far. I am on board with this character. I'm willing to give her a shot, even to the point where the chemistry would have to be there, but this is finally a version of Black Canary that I could buy as a legitimate romantic interest for Oliver.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I still want him and Felicity.
No,
but
yeah, I'm saying that. Yeah,
right. No, I totally agree with you. If they have to see if the chemistry is there, I wouldn't mind seeing it either. And I agree with everything you just said. She feels more like the Dinah Lance from the comics that I know and love, and the comic fans know and love. She's a badass from jump. She's not a legal assistant who has to learn how to fight average as the show goes on. She's a badass, a street fighter, takes no cap off of anybody, and isn't afraid to speak her mind to Oliver at a moment's notice. So far, so good on the new Black Canary, and the reveal of her name was cool. The only issue with her name is that I believe Laurel's mom's name on the show is also Drake, so... that's kind of an unusual coincidence, but I'm willing to overlook it because it was a cool little unexpected nod to the comics. And so far, so good. Another good episode of Arrow.
Absolutely. So should we rank them?
I'm trying to think if there's anything else this week. No, I think that was it. So I think we should rank them. I'm going to go very slightly, with a very slight lead. I'm going to go Legends, Arrow, Flash, and then Supergirl.
And I'm going to go Arrow, Legends, Flash, Supergirl.
Excellent. Excellent. So if you're out there, creators of Supergirl, step up your game and bring us some episodes.
I think after seeing the tease for next week's episode, for the episode 2 weeks from now, that seems to be getting back more to more of the Cadmus subplot, I think we're going to get a return to form for Supergirl.
I think so, too, because I think that one of the issues has been, as they have kind of lost sight of that Cadmus arc and focused on other stuff, is it hurt the show. They've lost that narrative through point. And so I think returning to that is going to help things kick back up in gear and hopefully give us some strong episodes on the back half of the season. But so far, the other shows killing it since the break. So looking forward to that. And hey, what coming up very, very soon, we got The Walking Dead coming back.
Yeah, on next week's show, we'll be talking a little Walking Dead, I believe, is the plan. So another of our stories returning to the airwaves. But a little bit of bonus content for you here this week in the watching subplot. And we'll start with the most immediate of those is finally, after many months, I have finished Daredevil Season 2 on the Netflix machine. And so I am finally ready to confront Greg over his baseless accusations of general apathy towards Karen Page. Listen, here's the deal. After seeing the entire season, I will say this. I'm fairly sure I liked it more than you did. I think the first 8 to 9 episodes are legitimately very good television. Maybe not quite to the level of season 1, to be fair. But still, really, really good, you know, gritty superhero television. The problem is, the final 4 episodes are back-to-back-to-back the worst episodes of the season. It feels like they didn't know how to land the plane, so to speak. They had all these subplots up in the air and weren't really sure where to let them fall. And in numerous cases, they didn't really let them fall at all. They kind of left them hanging there, which is a blatant tease for what I'm assuming is both the Defenders and a eventual third season of Daredevil. But I will agree with what your prior assessment that, you know, once they shifted the focus from the Punisher storyline and more onto the Elektra and the Hand storyline, it did lose some momentum. So ultimately, I will say I don't have as big of an issue with Karen Page in this season as you did, and I also enjoyed the season, I think, more on the whole than you did.
Preparation H always feels better on the whole.
Exactly.
I mean, listen, just like unlike you with your archism, no. I'm gonna own being an anti-Pageite. She totally lost me this year. I got nothing left for the character. Not interested in her anymore. I agree with you, of course, agreeing with me about the shift in characters changing the momentum of the show. I think for me it started a little bit earlier than it did for you. But, yeah, overall I just didn't think it had the consistency of season 1. And hopefully they'll bounce back in season 3. I think the ending was so underwhelming that it colored my perception of the rest of the series. But hopefully they can fix that in coming Netflix seasons.
Absolutely. Also, because I don't know where I found the time this week, but I actually watched all 13 episodes of Luke Cage. So I have finished Luke Cage as well. Greg has not yet begun Luke Cage, so we don't want to talk about it too in-depth, but I will say my brief thoughts on this. I enjoyed it. I did not love it. I think Greg will ultimately wind up liking it more than I did, mainly because it kind of has the feel of a 70s kind of action revenge movie, and it's got moments of a little bit of the cheese factor being upped in it, and it feels, like I said, very much like a 70s, you know, predominantly black cast action film, essentially. So I think you'll enjoy that, Greg. I think you'll enjoy the usage of music throughout it. However, it does have some issues. And one of the main issues is, much like Daredevil Season 2, there's a hard shift in the story in terms of a new antagonist that is introduced halfway through. And for my money, I found the initial antagonist of Kyle much more interesting than the subsequent antagonist of Diamondback. So that's just me. But also, you know, one of your issues, Greg, I think, with Karen Page in Season 2 of Daredevil was that she was constantly criticizing Matt and thinking he was wrong for everything he was doing, essentially. Is that correct?
That's one of the several issues, yes.
Okay. So
criticism with no suggestion for how to do things better.
Absolutely. So if you don't have an issue with Misty Knight after you watch Luke Cage Season 1, I'm going to kind of call you for some hypocrisy, because Misty's advice to Luke Cage for the vast majority of this show is, you're not helping, why don't you just go away and leave and never come back? Literally, she says that in like 5 different episodes. Luke, just leave Harlem and never come back. That all this work he's doing to take down a mob boss is just doing more harm than good. And that he should try to work within the system. Except for when he does work within the system and the system fails him. And she insists that the system still works even though the system just failed, blatantly. So had big problem with Misty Knight, not related to her coital affairs with Luke in the opening episode, because, as we all know, there's only one woman for Luke, and all I'm going to say is, Rosario Dawson, she better come on out and get her whooping and Ender starts. That's my opinion, anyway.
Is it possible? I don't know. I'd have to look up the credits, and I'm far too lazy to do that. Is it possible that the same creators behind Daredevil Season 2 were also responsible for Luke Cage?
No, this has a very different feel than Daredevil Season 2. You will see it. I mean, from a creative standpoint, is the only people who were really heavily involved with both of them would be Jeff Loeb and kind of the people over at Marvel Television proper. The showrunner, I believe, is an individual by the name of Cheo Hadari Coker. They lend their sensibilities to it, like I said, very, very much immersed in African-American culture, and you'll see that once you watch the episode. I mean, whether it's,
which is cool, yeah.
Which is whether it's discussions about basketball or boxing or, you know, gangster flicks and stuff like that. I mean, there are scenes set for shop where they discuss boxing, for example. So,
Speaking to me and my buddies from high school, yeah, good stuff.
So,
now that's cool. I'm looking forward to it. I just hope that it's not a trend in the Marvel Netflix shows now where they think they have to have two major villains in a season, because I think we both would agree that the best of the Marvel Netflix shows so far has been Jessica Jones, which had one central antagonist throughout the course of the whole season. And, you know, I think it's cool sometimes to mix that up, but I hope that the new trend is not thinking that you have to do a hard shift on the show halfway through to focus on a new threat, because I think that there's no reason why you can't make if Arrow in the two amazing seasons was able to make one central villain stretch over, what, 25, 26
Now, granted,
episodes.
But Arrow in the first two seasons didn't introduce – I remember Deathstroke doesn't pop up in the present day until the mid-season finale of season two. So you got to remember they're not exactly – 25, 26 episodes is not exactly true. It's not exactly true because Malcolm Merlyn's big reveal wasn't until around the mid-season finale of season one as well, I don't think.
True, but I'm not. But that's what I'm saying. You don't have to necessarily reveal the villain up front. But what I'm saying is the threat was there. The Dark Archer appears in the second episode of Arrow. Mm-hmm. And Brother Blood shows up in like the first or second episode of season two.
Right, so you have multiple antagonists, but not like, yeah, is revealed to be a pawn.
A
and
pawn
they try to do something like that in Luke Cage. The problem is, I think the guy who ultimately is just, you know, revealed to be one step down the chain is more charismatic and compelling than the guy who sits at the top of the food chain, in my opinion.
Right, which was not the case on Arrow. So,
yeah.
No, that's good. It's very good. I'm looking forward to watching that. We should also mention that the trailer for the next DC animated movie, Teen Titans The Judas Contract, is now out. We haven't watched it yet, which is why we haven't commented on it yet. So we both will watch that and try to find time to comment on it. Also, the newest DC animated movie, Justice League Dark, has been released, and we haven't watched that yet either. We will hopefully get to that at some point in the future.
I sadly have not yet watched Batman Return of the Caped Crusaders either, which was the previous.
Me either. DC I haven't watched that.
You know how much I was looking forward to that. So
absolutely. And I haven't watched Batman Bad Blood, which is the Dick Grayson Batman movie. So we're way behind.
Is that Dick is Batman in that? I didn't know.
Yep.
Huh.
Yep.
Learn something new every day.
So I really have some catching up to do. But why don't you tell the folks what we've got coming their way right here on the HTF podcast in the coming weeks?
Sure, absolutely. So the next 2 weeks we're going to be wrapping up the month, as we've called it. With next week will be an off the page featuring a look at what Greg and I both consider to be the best DC animated movie of all time, which is Batman Under the Red Hood. We'll be on that one and continuing to gush over things here. And then we'll be wrapping up the month with a countdown of our top five Marvel stories of all time. Now, I know you may be thinking, well, didn't you just do a top five Marvel events not that long ago? This doesn't necessarily have to be events. This can be stories in the titles. So this is going to be our top five Marvel stories of all time. So we're very much looking forward to doing that.
Absolutely. And as always, we want your feedback. What are your thoughts on the Sinestro Corps? Give us your thoughts, your feedback, your favorite moments, your favorite characters, your favorite standout moments. What are your thoughts on the DC movie universe? I'm certain that's a controversial topic right now, so let us know about that. What are your thoughts on the weekly DC shows? What were the rankings? What are your thoughts on Legion, which we haven't touched on yet because neither of us have watched it yet, but we hopefully will have a chance to watch and discuss Legion next week. If you have thoughts on any of this or anything you'd like to hear us talk about on the show, send us your feedback. I am Greg P at PlaceToBeNation.com. He is Nick D at PlaceToBeNation.com. Find us on Twitter at gphillips8652. That's gphillips852. He is at nickduke87, nickduke87. And, of course, we invite you again to join us on Facebook at our Place to Be Nation Comic. Just search for it in your Facebook toolbar. Join our group. It's a great group. Lots of fun people there. Discussions, jokes, in-jokes that you can be part of and catch on to some of our in-jokes, perhaps. We always welcome discussion there. So those are the ways you can get in touch with us. And please let us know your thoughts on this and any number of topics. And as always, if you want to find our archive of print material on the website from our old columns, etc., and our original giant sizes, go on there. Or if you're really feeling frisky, the Place to Be Nation biennial comic book draft. You can find those on placetobenation.com in the comics archives. So dig through that at your leisure. Other than that, Nick, do you have anything else for the good people out there?
Just to mention that we can go ahead and – I want to go ahead and reveal that Greg just mentioned the biennial comics draft. We had toyed with the idea of making that an annual draft. For the time being, it will remain biennial because this year, in its place, we are going to be debuting a new concept that we're not quite ready to talk about. But it might be even more bizarre and nerdy than the draft itself.
That's not possible.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see.
True. True enough. Well, with all that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we are happy that you joined today. We know there's a lot going on in the world. Your Facebook feed is probably not very pleasing to you at the moment. But we do hope that we've been able to entertain you for a while. And likewise, I hope that you go out on Amazon or at a local comic book shop, preferably, find yourself a copy of the Sinestro Corps War, and it will open your eyes to the greatness of the Green Lantern Corps and why it's, in many people's eyes, one of, in my eyes, the greatest mythology in superhero comics. It's truly something for the ages. And, go and check that out. Go and watch the CW shows. Go and read as much as you can of these comic books. Support the creators. Support the artists and writers. And in closing, I leave you with this. In blackest day, brightest night, beware your fears made into light. Let those who try to stop what's right burn like my power, Sinestro's might.
At black masses, evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction, in the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning, death and hatred to mankind. Poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah. darkness world stops turning. Ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power. And as God has struck the hour, day of judgment, God is calling. On the knees, the war pigs crawling, begging mercies for the sins. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh!